Chapter 41. Frown. Call it that, then I must go, she said, drawing her little watch from her bosom. She turned away, and he followed and caught her by the wrist. Well then, come to me once, he said, his head turning suddenly at the thought of losing her, and for a second or two they looked at each other almost like enemies. When, he insisted. Tomorrow? She hesitated. The day after. Dearest, he said again. As he had disengaged her wrist, but for a moment they continued to hold each other's eyes, and he saw that her face, which had grown very pale, was flooded with a deep inner radiance. His heart beat with awe. He felt that he had never before beheld love visible. Oh, I shall be late, goodbye. No, don't come any farther than this, she cried, walking hurriedly away down the long room, as if the reflected radiance in his eyes had frightened her. When she reached the door she turned for a moment, to wave a quick farewell. Archer walked home alone. Darkness was falling when he let himself into his house, and he looked about at the familiar objects in the hall, as if he viewed them from the other side of the grave. The parlor maid, hearing his step, ran up the stairs, to light the gas on the upper landing. Is Mrs. Archer in? No, sir. Mrs. Archer went out in the carriage after luncheon, and hasn't come back. With a sense of relief he entered the library, and flung himself down in his armchair. The parlor maid followed, bringing the student lamp and shaking some coals onto the dying fire. When she left he continued to sit motionless, his elbows on his knees, his chin on his clasped hands, his eyes fixed on the red grate. He sat there without conscious thoughts, without sense of the lapse of time, in a deep and grave amazement that seemed to suspend life, rather than quicken it. This was what had to be then. This was what had to be, he kept repeating to himself, as if he hung in the clutch of doom. What he had dreamed of had been so different, that there was a mortal chill in his rapture. The door opened and May came in. I'm dreadfully late, you weren't worried, were you? She asked, laying her hand on his shoulder with one of her rare caresses. He looked up astonished. Is it late? After 7. I believe you've been asleep. She laughed, and drawing out her hatpins tossed her velvet hat on the sofa. She looked paler than usual, but sparkling with an unwonted animation. I went to see Granny, and just as I was going away Ellen came in from a walk, so I stayed, and had a long talk with her. It was ages since we'd had a real talk. As he had dropped into her usual armchair, facing his, and was running her fingers through her rumpled hair. He fancied she expected him to speak. A really good talk, she went on, smiling with what seemed to Archer an unnatural vividness. He was so dear, just like the old Ellen. I'm afraid I haven't been fair to her lately. I've sometimes thought, Archer stood up and leaned against the mantelpiece, out of the radius of the lamp. Yes, you thought, he echoed as she paused. Well, perhaps I haven't judged her fairly. She's so different, at least on the surface. She takes up such odd people, she seems to like to make herself conspicuous. I suppose it's the life she's led in, that fast European society, no doubt we seem dreadfully dull to her. But I don't want to judge her unfairly. She paused again, a little breathless with the unwonted length of her speech, and sat with her lips slightly parted, and a deep blush on her cheeks. Archer, as he looked at her, was reminded of the glow which had suffused her face in the mission garden at St. Augustine. He became aware of the same obscure effort in her, the same reaching out toward something beyond the usual range of her vision. She hates Ellen, he thought, and she's trying to overcome the feeling, and to get me to help her to overcome it. The thought moved him, and for a moment he was on the point of breaking the silence between them, and throwing himself on her mercy. You understand, don't you, she went on, why the family have sometimes been annoyed. We all did what we could for her at first, but she never seemed to understand. And now this idea of going to see Mrs. Beaufort, of going there in Granny's carriage. I'm afraid she's quite alienated the van der Leydens. Said Archer with an impatient laugh. The open door had closed between them again. It's time to dress. We're dining out, aren't we? He asked, moving from the fire. She rose also, but lingered near the hearth. As he walked past her, she moved forward impulsively, as though to detain him. Their eyes met, and he saw that hers were of the same swimming blue as when he had left her to drive to Jersey City. She flung her arms about his neck and pressed her cheek to his. You haven't kissed me today, she said in a whisper, and he felt her tremble in his arms. XXXII. At the court of the Tuileries, said Mr. Sillerton Jackson with his reminiscent smile, such things were pretty openly tolerated. The scene was the van der Leyden's black walnut dining room in Madison Avenue, and the time the evening after Newland Archer's visit to the Museum of Art. Mr. and Mrs. van der Leyden had come to town for a few days from Schuylkill, whither they had precipitately fled at the announcement of Beaufort's failure. It had been represented to them that the disarray into which society had been thrown by this deplorable affair made their presence in town more necessary than ever. It was one of the occasions when, as Mrs. Archer put it, they wedded to society to show themselves at the opera, and even to open their own doors. It will never do, my dear Louisa, to let people like Mrs. Lemuel Struthers think they can step into Regina's shoes. It is just at such times that new people push in and get a footing. It was owing to the epidemic of chicken pox in New York the winter Mrs. Struthers first appeared that the married men slipped away to her house while their wives were in the nursery. You and dear Henry, Louisa, must stand in the breach as you always have. Mr. and Mrs. van der Leyden could not remain deaf to such a call, and reluctantly but heroically they had come to town, unmuffled the house, and sent out invitations for two dinners and an evening reception. On this particular evening they had invited Sillerton Jackson, Mrs. Archer and Newland and his wife, to go with them to the opera, where Faust was being sung for the first time that winter. Nothing was done without ceremony under the van der Leyden roof, and though there were but four guests the repast had begun at 7 punctually, so that the proper sequence of courses might be served without haste before the gentlemen settled down to their cigars. Archer had not seen his wife since the evening before. He had left early for the office, where he had plunged into an accumulation of unimportant business. In the afternoon one of the senior partners had made an unexpected call on his time, and he had reached home so late that May had preceded him to the van der Leyden's and sent back the carriage. Now, across the Schuylkill carnations and the massive plate, she struck him as pale and languid, but her eyes shone, and she talked with exaggerated animation. The subject which had called forth Mr. Sillerton Jackson's favorite allusion had been brought up, Archer fancied, not without intention, by their hostess. The Beaufort failure, or rather the Beaufort attitude since the failure, was still a fruitful theme for the drawing-room moralist, and after it had been thoroughly examined and condemned, Mrs. van der Leyden had turned her scrupulous eyes on May Archer. Is it possible, dear, that what I hear is true? I was told your grandmother Mingott's carriage was seen standing at Mrs. Beaufort's door. It was noticeable that she no longer called the offending lady by her Christian name. May's color rose, and Mrs. Archer put in hastily. If it was, I'm convinced it was there without Mrs. Mingott's knowledge. Ah, you think? Mrs. van der Leyden paused, sighed, and glanced at her husband. I'm afraid, Mr. van der Leyden said, that Madame Olenska's kind heart may have led her into the imprudence of calling on Mrs. Beaufort. Or her taste for peculiar people, put in Mrs. Archer in a dry tone, while her eyes dwelt innocently on her son's. I'm sorry to think it of Madame Olenska, said Mrs. van der Leyden, and Mrs. Archer murmured. Ah, my dear, and after you'd had her twice at Schuylkill. It was at this point that Mr. Jackson seized the chance to place his favorite allusion. At the Tuileries, he repeated, Seeing the eyes of the company expectantly turned on him, the standard was excessively lax in some respects. And if you'd asked where Morney's money came from or who paid the debts of some of the court beauties. Dot, I hope, dear Sillerton, said Mrs. Archer, you are not suggesting that we should adopt such standards? I never suggest, returned Mr. Jackson imperturbably. But Madame Olenska's foreign bringing up may make her less particular, the two elder ladies sighed. Still, to have kept her grandmother's carriage at a defaulter's door, Mr. van der Luyden protested, and Archer guessed that he was remembering and resenting the hampers of carnations he had sent to the little house in 23rd Street. Of course I've always said that she looks at things quite differently, Mrs. Archer summed up. A flush rose to May's forehead. She looked across the table at her husband and said precipitately, I'm sure Ellen meant it kindly. Imprudent people are often kind, said Mrs. Archer, as if the fact were scarcely an extenuation. And Mrs. van der Luyden murmured, if only as he had consulted someone, that she never did, Mrs. Archer rejoined. At this point Mr. van der Luyden glanced at his wife, who bent her head slightly in the direction of Mrs. Archer, and the glimmering trains of the three ladies swept out of the door, while the gentlemen settled down to their cigars. Mr. van der Luyden supplied short ones on opera nights, but they were so good that they made his guests deplore his inexorable punctuality. Archer, after the first act, had detached himself from the party and made his way to the back of the club box. From there he watched, over various Chivers, Mingott, and Rushworth shoulders, the same scene that he had looked at 2 years previously, on the night of his first meeting with Ellen Olenska. He had half-dash expected her to appear again in old Mrs. Mingott's box, but it remained empty, and he sat motionless, his eyes fastened on it, till suddenly Madame Nilsson's pure soprano broke out into Amma, non mamma. Dot Archer turned to the stage, where, in the familiar setting of giant roses and pen wiper pansies, the same large blonde victim was succumbing to the same small brown seducer. From the stage his eyes wandered to the point of the horseshoe, where May sat between two older ladies, just as, on that former evening, as he had sat between Mrs. Lovell Mingott and her newly arrived foreign cousin. As on that evening, she was all in white, and Archer, who had not noticed what she wore, recognized the blue-white satin and old lace of her wedding dress. It was the custom, in old New York, for brides to Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.